his view of what Congress can do to protect people and just generally to legislate is much narrower than is really acceptable for a mainstream justice.
They chat to startled pedestrians and hand out candy to passing children.
If we go out into the streets just dressed in normal clothes, no one will pay any attention.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Canada's marriage bill crosses the threshold. U.S. rights groups fear Roberts is the wrong supreme. And La Familia Galan seduces Bolivia. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Rick Watts.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending July 23, 2005. 2 years after a court ruling first opened civil marriage to same-gender couples in the province of Ontario, Canada's national legislators have followed suit. This week, after a vigorous debate, the Canadian Senate gave 70% approval to the government's Bill C-38, which the Parliament had already passed last month. Despite pleas from opponents for Queen Elizabeth to block the measure, royal assent was quickly granted. With the Governor General out on medical leave, it was Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Canada, Beverly McLaughlin, who actually signed the measure into law on behalf of the Crown. That made Canada the fourth nation in the world, and the first outside of Europe, to grant marriage equality to same-gender couples. The first three were the Netherlands, Belgium, and Spain. Most of Canada's provinces and one territory had already been marrying gay and lesbian couples. The holdout with the largest population is Alberta, where the first gay male couple applied for a marriage license within an hour of the federal bill becoming law. Four other same-gender couples applied for licenses in Alberta on the first day they could. Those licenses identify them as Partner 1 and Partner 2 instead of Bride and Groom.
Canada's National Opposition Conservative Party remains determined to make marriage equality a campaign issue and to attempt to repeal C-38 in the future. But they've been losing ground to the ruling Liberal Party in recent polls. The many lesbian-gay activists who worked long and hard for this week's victory were elated and proud. Perhaps the most telling celebration was the dismantling of the lobby group Canadians for Equal Marriage. Spokesperson Laurie Aron told the Washington Blade newspaper, "Our goal has been accomplished. We will close down."
But a legislative win doesn't necessarily end the struggle, as same-gender couples are discovering in Spain. The marriage equality law there went into effect earlier this month. But while the new law amends the civil code, this week, a judge blocked a lesbian couple's union on constitutional grounds. Judge Laura Alabao in the town of Denia in the southeastern state of Alicante filed a challenge to the new law because the national constitution describes marriage only as between a man and a woman. The chief justice of Spain's top court, Francisco José Hernando, told Agence France-Presse that the judge was acting within his rights if he believes the new law contains unconstitutional aspects. Whether or not that particular case heads to the National Constitutional Court, the opposition Partido Popular is considering moving for a constitutional challenge, confident it can muster the 50 votes needed from national legislators. To the national lesbian, gay, and trans group Colegas, Alabao's action is a form of conscientious objection that constitutes flagrant legal rebellion and disobedience of the law. Meanwhile, what's being reported as Spain's first legal wedding of a lesbian couple was performed this week in a town near Barcelona. To the dismay of the couple, who would not make their last names public and asked that their faces not be photographed, reporters outnumbered their friends and family at the ceremony by about 3-1.
Belgium's Interior Ministry this week reported some official statistics on marriages of gay and lesbian couples there. A total of 2,442 same-gender couples have married since it became legal in September of 2003. They currently make up 3% of marriages performed in Belgium.
The Greek Orthodox Church is denouncing an opposition party's support for marriage equality. Last week, the leader of the Greek left-wing Synespismos Coalition declared that position to a group of lesbo-gay activists. Bishop Anthimos of Thessaloniki has labeled that stance as one of impudence and shame, adding that gay people warp human nature with unspeakable, unnatural acts. Coalition leader Alekos Alavanos took the salvo in stride, saying he'd expected that reaction from the church.
This week, an Italian opposition leader came forward to call for legal recognition of same-gender couples there, according to ANSA. Romano Prodi leads the Union Coalition, described as center-left, which has not taken such a stand before. While acknowledging some differences on details, he declared that the entire coalition supports creation of registered partnerships similar to France's Pacts of Civil Solidarity, adding that, "We share a common line on solidarity and recognition for the civil rights of gays." Union is currently leading the polls to take power following next year's national elections. The party's been under some pressure from the largest opposition party, the Democratic Left, to make partnerships part of its campaign platform. No less than 6 partnership bills have been in progress in the Italian parliament for more than a year, but the ruling Forza Italia party has stalled them.
There's an international furor over the execution of 2 Iranian teenagers this week. They're identified only as M.A. and A.M., one 18 years old and the other less than 18. According to the Iranian Students News Agency and the Opposition National Council of Resistance of Iran, which considers itself the nation's government in exile, the 2 young men were convicted of having sex with each other, confessing to that, but saying they didn't know it was a capital crime. Some activists believe even that confession resulted from torture. It's agreed that the young men were incarcerated for 14 months and were lashed well over 200 times before their public hanging. But some other sources have reported the conviction was actually for raping at knife point a boy of 13, which is below the age of consent. The U.S. lesbo-gay advocacy group Human Rights Campaign called on the Secretary of State to condemn the executions. The Swedish lesbo-gay group RFSL has called on its government to stop deportations of Iranian gays. And the British direct action group Outrage called for an end to diplomatic and trade ties with Iran.
The Islamic Sharia law that prescribes execution for homosexual acts in Iran is also effective in Nigeria. Earlier this month, United Nations Commission on Human Rights Special Rapporteur Philip Alston called for a review of Nigeria's entire process in convicting a man of sodomy and sentencing him to death by stoning, calling the punishment wholly disproportionate with respect to international law. Although a court had acquitted the man of alleged homosexual act with someone much younger, the judge asked him if there had been other times he had had sex with men. When he said yes, he was convicted of sodomy and now awaits execution. Then last week, 2 other men were brought to trial after allegedly having sex in a toilet. When the prosecution failed to present any witnesses against them, the judge continued the case to give prosecutors more time to develop evidence. They also could face a death sentence.
Meanwhile, the suspect in the brutal murder of Sierra Leone's leading lesbian activist, Fannie Ann Eddy, reportedly escaped from custody this week.
And in Uganda, national police this week raided the home of the leader of Sexual Minorities Uganda, the nation's only lesbo-gay activist group. A report on the African lesbo-gay website Behind the Mask says that police confiscated everything that appeared to have homosexual content. Victor Juliet Mukasa wasn't in her home at the time, but police detained instead a visiting Kenyan activist who was there.
Lesbo-gays in Latvia are marching for pride for the first time ever in Riga, thanks to a legal ruling that trumped opposition, including the prime minister. PM Edgars Kalvaitis this week publicly declared it was not acceptable for a parade of sexual minorities to pass the Dom Cathedral in the nation's capital. He insisted that Latvia is a state based on Christian values. We cannot promote things that are unacceptable to a large part of society. The Riga City Council took up his position and canceled the permit for the march, with a city spokesperson warning that the majority of society was against it and it could result in unrest. The spokesperson said the city had received masses of letters and emails against the march, including some from extremist groups who threatened to disrupt it. 2 major churches and several members of parliament had been actively campaigning against the march. Riga Pride organizers responded with a lawsuit claiming a violation of their constitutional rights. The Regional Administrative Court agreed and ordered the city to reissue the permit, saying officials had failed to demonstrate adequate grounds for its withdrawal. The city said there wasn't time to physically issue a new permit, but conceded it would allow the march to proceed legally. Pride organizers had been prepared to march regardless, and they'd also organized their own international letter-writing campaign of protest.
Earlier this month in Turkey, more than 150 people marched for Pride in Istanbul's 12th annual celebration.
And finally, photographic equipment manufacturer Eastman Kodak has taken an unusual step for a major corporation. One section of the company website is now entitled Pride at Kodak, to specifically highlight Kodak's commitment to lesbian, gay, and trans people in their roles as its workers, customers, and suppliers. It's the corporate response to the company's own Lambda network of lesbian, gay, and trans employees. You can check it out at www.kodak.com/go/pride and have a proud Kodak moment.
That's News Wrap for the week ending July 23rd, 2005. Written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK, Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Rick Watts.
Is it political performance art, or is it just screwing around? You'll get the answer and a rare look at the queer equality movement in Bolivia later in the program. The Log Cabin Republicans, a gay GOP group, has taken a wait-and-see approach to President George W. Bush's nomination this week of John G. Roberts to replace the retiring Sandra Day O'Connor on the U.S. Supreme Court. Other queer advocacy groups, including Lambda Legal, the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, and the Human Rights Campaign, have not yet expressed direct opposition, but they have expressed, respectively, serious concern, grave pause, and grave concern. Underscoring that anxiety is the glee with which virtually all right-wing groups in the country have embraced the nomination. O'Connor has often been the swing vote on a closely divided court and ruled with the majority in the 2003 Lawrence case overturning U.S. sodomy laws. Human Rights Campaign senior counsel Lara Schwartz briefed the GOBT media about Roberts and the confirmation process to come during a telephone press conference this week.
Just by way of brief background on Judge Roberts, he has been on the United States Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit since 2003. He was nominated to that court by our current president. Previous to that, he was in private practice at the D.C. law firm of Hogan & Hartson. He was a political appointee to the Solicitor General's office in the first President Bush's administration and also a counsel in the Reagan administration. So he is a basically lifelong worker for Republican administrations. He was a law clerk to Justice Rehnquist, and he's a graduate of Harvard Law School. There is not a paper trail regarding Judge Roberts' specific views regarding the rights and liberties and constitutional and legal protections for the GLBT community. When we look at a potential judge, a judicial nominee, there are aspects of their legal background and their legal and judicial philosophy that can serve as means to assess how they will judge a case that concerns the rights of this community. In particular, the right to reproductive choice and support for the Supreme Court's decision in Roe v. Wade is an indicator of readiness to embrace and protect constitutional protections for GLBT people. The reasons for that are two. One is that the Lawrence v. Texas case, the 2003 decision holding sodomy laws unconstitutional, cites Roe and the cases before it as its foundation. So there's a legal intertwining. The other is a basic philosophy of looking at the Constitution as a living document and understanding that even if a specific word is not stated in the Constitution, such as sex or abortion or gay, that does not mean that Americans, such as the GLBT community, do not hold fundamental rights that the Constitution protects. Judge Roberts does have a record of opposition to reproductive choice. When he was a solicitor, deputy solicitor general in the first Bush administration, he co-authored a brief in a case regarding funding for abortion. So the validity of Roe v. Wade wasn't directly an issue that was presented in the case, but he nonetheless argued that Roe v. Wade was wrongly decided and should be overruled. That is an aggressive position on choice, and it warrants further further investigation because of the importance of choice and constitutional privacy constitutionally for GLBT communities and civil rights generally. He's also authored a brief urging the court to rule that it is constitutional for a public school to sponsor prayer at graduation. The Supreme Court rejected that position 5-4 and rejected Roberts' argument that the way that the court assesses constitutional claims about separation of church and state should be weakened. Church-state separation is another area that is a real indicator of a nominee's willingness to enforce the rights of minorities, whether it is religious minorities or groups such as the GLBT community for whom religious belief is often used as a proxy for discrimination. So that's extremely important. Another area legally that we look at HRC and in the progressive civil rights community generally is their view on Congress's power to enact laws that protect against discrimination, protect against bias, violence, protect the environment, etc. There has been a movement that has really been the signature of the Rehnquist Court and of Justices Scalia and Thomas in particular to rule in a very novel way that various provisions of the Constitution prevent Congress from helping people, whether it's through clean water or protections against discrimination, protections for people with disabilities, another important issue for the community due to the disproportionate impact of HIV. And Judge Roberts, since he's become a judge, has issued a dissent that indicates that his view of what Congress can do to protect people and just generally to legislate is much narrower than his colleagues on the D.C. Circuit and is much narrower than is really acceptable for a mainstream justice. You know, as a community, we look forward to seeing more legal protections such as discrimination protections, protection from hate violence, et cetera, and to eventually achieve those victories only to have them chipped away by a court that is hostile to them is got to be of grave concern to this community. Now, in the upcoming weeks, one thing that is going to come up is that groups supporting Roberts' nomination and supporting, you know, and who have supported the president's nominees generally and really disparaged those who question the nominees are going to make a couple of claims that I just want to refute here legally. One is going to be that there's just no grounds to question a nominee's ideology, that if they're very well qualified, it's out of bounds to ask, you know, what do you think about Roe? What do you think about Lawrence? What do you think about the Romer case about equal protection for GLBT people? That's not true. It hasn't been true in the over 200 years that the Senate has been, you know, assessing these Supreme Court nominees, and it's not true today. And people as diverse as Arlen Specter and Chief Justice Rehnquist have said that it isn't true. Roberts is very much accountable to the Senate to be clear about his philosophies and intentions regarding constitutional rights. Another thing that's going to be bandied about that's not legal but political is that any kind of aggressive questioning of Roberts' record on either church-state issues or abortion-related issues is a direct attack on him as a person of faith. In our work for the GLBT community, that we've seen these kind of attacks before. We've seen labels of bigotry hurled at people who object to religious discrimination or discrimination in general by people who happen to be people of faith. It's something to be on guard for, and I think that you know, we at HRC are going to be working to demonstrate that questioning a person's ideology is not an attack on them as a human being or on their personal beliefs.
That was Laura Schwartz, Human Rights Campaign Senior Counsel, discussing this week's nomination by President Bush of John G. Roberts to the U.S. Supreme Court. His confirmation will require a two-thirds majority of the Senate, which means a few Democrats will have to vote with the GOP majority in order for the 50-year-old Roberts to win a lifetime appointment to the highest court in the land. Confirmation hearings are expected to begin in early September.
I'm Roman Kalinin from Moscow. You are listening to This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian radio magazine. Оставайтесь на нашей волне.
Stay on our wavelength.
They were one of the highlights of the La Paz Pride March, but their frequent presence on the streets of Bolivia's capital make them much more than a parade contingent. They grew out of traditional drag pageants, but their political perspective has grown way beyond female impersonation. It's transformative 21st century activism, and it's happening where you might least expect it. This Way Out correspondent Linda Farthing gets into the family way with La Paz's La Familia Galan.
The most indigenous country in the Americas is hardly a place you would expect to find a loudly public group of genderbenders. But since 2002, on any given weekend day in Bolivia's capital, La Paz, men and an occasional woman, dressed in often bizarre outfits, can be found strolling and strutting through the streets. They chat to startled pedestrians and hand out candy to passing children. La Familia Galan, or the Galan family as they are known, mixes irreverence for convention with challenges to stereotypes, all carried out through the inimitable humor of drag. Paris Galán is one of the key figures.
The important and interesting thing about transformism is simply to express yourself. But there's a common element for me particularly, which is to draw attention. For all of our political demands to be real, if we go out into the streets just dressed in normal clothes, no one will pay any attention. We want to cause fascination in people. We don't give people time to make negative criticisms, to assault us or insult us. When they realize what we are already part of their families, among their friends and their organizations.
De sus organizaciones, de sus instituciones.
La Familia, now numbering about 25, has its origins in a group of drag queens who began appearing in 1996, late at night in small, obscure bars. From these early drag pageants, they left the night behind and publicly pushed the boundaries of traditional drag into a very different and often extreme form. No longer are they limited to simply imitating women. Dana Galán explains.
El transformismo es más un deseo.
Transforming myself, more than anything, is a desire to take control of my body and to take pleasure in changing myself. Transforming for me in particular is a political strategy. It gives me the opportunity to reject being controlled by my fears. For me, it's desire, passion, and fantasy.
Carlos Galán is a British sociologist who has been living in Bolivia for many years. Her research on gender and postmodernism led her to join the family.
I first met the Familia Galán in December 2000. It was around Human Rights Day, International Human Rights Day. And I and the activist companion had organized a big festival in a large public square in La Paz. And it was to celebrate sexual rights within human rights for International Human Rights Day. And somebody suggested we invited this group of drag queens to dance. And they did a series of dances in not just drag feminized gear, but also androgynous, devil-like, animal-like. And I remember Paris, for example, saying, we're not pretending to be women. We're guys wearing wigs, makeup, and heels. So what?
So do they see themselves as gay, as transvestites? Carlos Galán.
We don't identify by sexual orientation or option. We identify by gender performance and also by the whole thing of transformismo, of transforming. It's kind of almost a condition in the family Galán that you do something performative with your body and with dress in public. That's what unites us. The thing about sexual option orientation is diverse, changing. I would say we're more queer than anything else. Different members of the family would use different words to describe their sexual preference, but that's not out there for public scrutiny, what we do in bed or out of bed with people. It's more a question of how we choose to perform gender.
The Galán refuse to be victims in a country that has been exploited ever since the Spanish conquerors hauled away unimaginable amounts of silver. Nowadays, modern multinational corporations are after Bolivia's rich oil and gas resources. Dana Galán explains the Galán perspective.
Que no dejamos que
we don't let discrimination and exclusion limit us from gaining and exercising our rights. We begin from a logic of appropriating our rights rather than feeling we are victims who have to wait for others to grant them to us. I am the representative of my own life, of my own body. So for this reason, I must win these rights and make alliances with other oppressed groups.
In April 2004, before the most conservative Christian churches got wind of it, the Bolivian Congress passed a comprehensive sexual and reproductive rights law, which contained explicit protection for sexual minorities. But the bill has languished for over a year because the president hesitated in signing it, calling for broader public debate on the controversial issues it encompasses, from rights to sexual pleasure to birth control. The churches have reacted with fury, calling for respect for what they call the natural family. Paris explains what family means to La Galán.
Family for us is a configuration of people and members who do everything together. Live together, have fun together, have great moments, have difficult moments. Sometimes we have serious and difficult discussions. With the special ingredient that we are neither a biological nor traditional family, and we make decisions together.
Changing a homophobic and machista society like Bolivia's is far from easy, but La Familia Galán have their own vision of the process. Dana Galán.
Busco seducir, si quieres, en cierta
I am looking to seduce and change the cultural situation we live in, starting from the idea of a family as a movement, forming a different kind of political and cultural family that interacts with other social movements and achieves a change in the dominant paradigm of sexuality, of gender, only women and men, masculine and feminine, which ignores the richness of sexual diversities. Each person constructs his or her own sexuality and gender in his or her own way.
Galán are determined to follow their own creative paths, which defy conceptions of any kind. This has made them a curiosity in the local media, which only began acknowledging that sexual minorities exist in Bolivia in 1994. The Galán have seized this space effectively, and besides producing a play and working on a film, just had a photo exhibit showing at a La Paz gallery. But rebellion is always close to the surface. They remain committed to joder en serio, as Dana explains.
Bueno, joder en serio ha sido...
To screw around seriously is in reality a project and a characteristic of the Familia Galán. All our activities have begun with screwing around, from a night out on the streets or a night between lovers. By organizing this action means that the screwing around of that moment becomes something serious. But that doesn't mean that the element of screwing around doesn't remain in everything we do.
Toda la parte de joda que ha existido.
For This Way Out, this is Linda Farthing in La Paz, Bolivia.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Rick Watts, Graham Underhill, Rex Walkner, and Linda Farthing contributed program material. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Don't forget, you can listen to This Way Out online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are underwritten by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. Please find out how you can help keep this program on the air by visiting our website. For all that and more, please do log on to thiswayout.org. You can also email us at tworadio@aol.com or write to Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on KOPN, Columbia, Missouri, WRSU, New Brunswick, New Jersey, CFRU, Guelph, Ontario, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.